Kane in Los Angeles and Detroit, and there's in Washington. I mean, it's right, but it's more there. We have an unprecedented number of murders, 369 murders. I don't know why we have that number. Chief Fuller and I have looked at it, tried to figure out why we have so many people killing each other. We had 5 killings over the weekend, between Friday and this morning. Crack cocaine brings with it violence. We don't know why. It happened in Detroit, it happened in New York. Our method is try to get the community involved. We try to say to people, police power by itself can't solve these murders. These are drug-related murders. 80% of them are targeted. The victim knew the killer, or the killer knew the killee, and that 80% of them have drugs on around their bodies or in their system when they're killed. Over the weekend, one guy had $11,000 and a whole quantity of heroin in his pocket when he was killed. And these are targeted. These are people who say, we're going to kill you because this is the way of the streets. This is our way of saying, you can't mess with my drugs. You can't mess with my money. We had a 13-year-old named Derek Hunter killed at 2:30 in the morning because he owed a drug dealer $1,300. Now, no mayor can solve it by himself or herself. I think the solution to that is for the community to get involved massively. Say, we're not going to take it anymore. I'm convinced that somebody in Washington knows the identity of the people who killed 369 people. Because the idea of killing, let somebody know you did it, so you can scare somebody off. Somebody said, I killed him because he messed with my drugs. I messed with me again, you're going to get killed too. So somebody knows that. I don't want them to snitch on the streets, but they ought to come forward and do anonymous telephone lines and say, here's who killed so-and-so and so. We also are trying to get community patrol themselves. We have community patrols, so people can get out in the community and patrol themselves. We have hotlines for people to give tips as to who's doing what, where drugs are being sold. We're also locking folks up too. I mean, that's no solution by itself. We locked up, we arrested over 47,000 people the last 3 years. We have 12,000 people in jail, 13,000 on probation, 4,000 on parole, 9,000 waiting in trials now. So we've been trying the criminal side of it. That doesn't work by itself. We now got to try the human side, the community side, and try to get the community to say, this is our problem, not just Marion Barry's problem. This is our community. Well, I live in Ward 3, which is a predominantly white ward, or Ward 8, which is a predominantly black ward. This is our problem. This is our community. Until we stand up and say, no, we're not going to take it anymore, we're going to continue to have those murders. When people stand up and say, we're not going to take it anymore, we're going to stop it, we're going to change the philosophy of this city, that we're not going to let drug dealers and drug users shoot up each other. I'm going to turn people in who have guns. I'm going to tell them my neighbor, tell them my daughter, or my son, whoever it is, I'm going to tell on them. Then we begin to get those murders down. Until that happens, they're going to continue to grow, in my view. Does that answer your question? But again, it's not limited to Washington. Every city, Baltimore, is experiencing a 150% increase in murders this year. Prince George's County, which is our neighbor to the east, had 106 murders last year. They're now up to 102. So it's happening all over America. Chicago murder rate is up slightly. New York is up slightly. But why Washington with crack cocaine, I really don't know.
You mentioned Baltimore, so that leads right to my question, which is that the mayor of Baltimore about a year ago advocated the decriminalization of drugs as a solution to the problem of crime caused by drugs. How do you feel about this proposal?
I supported Mayor Smoke's efforts to start a national dialogue on the subject. Let people talk about it. I'm opposed to decriminalization. I'm opposed to decriminalization for a lot of reasons. One is that PCP literally eats up your brain cells. I mean, it literally eats your brain cells up. It makes you crazy. And brain cells, you probably know, only cells in the body don't reproduce themselves, which means once they're gone. Crack cocaine is so addictive that it destroys all of your mental ability to think. It blocks your memory. It does a whole bunch of physiological things that's bad for your body. Heroin is bad for your body. And so I'm opposed to decriminalization for health reasons, for moral reasons, and for real reasons. The more cocaine you smoke, the more you want, which means if you decriminalize it, you have people smoking dope all day, every day. Not like heroin, which sort of gets you to nod off. Cocaine goes to the sex center and the pleasure center of the brains. If I were for anything, and I'm not saying I am, I may be persuaded to be for decriminalization of marijuana, only because it's not causing us a greater problem as the other. We spend our time on the real problem. But marijuana is bad for you too. your body physiologically. The study's shown that it damages your brain, damages your heart. And so we have, in Washington, I went out to D.C. General Hospital, which is our general hospital, public hospital, about 3 months ago. There were 60 babies out there. 50 of the 60 had been born addicted to cocaine. Mothers who had used cocaine during their pregnancy. 50 of the 60. 8 of the 60 had been abandoned by their fathers and by their mothers and now aborted babies, belonging to the state. If we legalize it or decriminalize it, I don't know the difference between the two, it's going to mean more crack cocaine babies being born. Mean more people going to the hospital with deformed hearts because crack cocaine enlarges your heart. More people dying from other kind of physiological problems. So I'm opposed to it. I was for the debate. The debate ought to stop now. Let's go on and try to cut this stuff out at the source. Let's go to Bolivia. Let's go to Peru. Let's take the United States Army, Marines, Air Force, and Navy, and go down to help the government of Peru and Colombia and Bolivia. Let's kill the people who are producing drugs in Colombia or put them in jail. Let's blockade those countries and so that drugs can't come across the seas. Let's look at every airline that comes in here, every ship, and let's stop it at its source. That's what we need to do. Where? Oh, yeah. Right down, right, Route 7-8.
And the funny thing is that while there has been a lot of, and I guess you can say it's been changed, but it seems to me it's been very superficial. The numbers of people, especially by participating in the is incredibly and going into public service. And I think that would be interesting. And I mean, public service in general is, it's essentially a going home thing. And you're always going home in a sense when you do public service, whether it's to, because the society raises you up. And when you do public service, you're giving back. So it's always a sense of return. And so in this context of Mississippi, I think you might want to argue that.
In terms of Mississippi, Mississippi still has us. A lot of problems between blacks and whites, even though it does have 40% of its registration is black, even though it has the largest number of black elected officials in any state in the nation. There's still a lot to be done in Mississippi, not just in the area of black people, but there are a lot of poor white people in Mississippi, too, who need some help from the government sector, both local, county, and state. And I think that you've been fortunate to be able to come to where you are. I don't know about your circumstances, but certainly you're here at Harvard, and you appear to be physically normal with two eyes and two arms, two legs, and seven toes. And therefore, you'll be blessed by God to be here. And therefore, it seems to me that if you've been blessed by God to have achieved this status, a lot of hard work on your part, a lot of other people's part, I'm sure, you have a moral responsibility to give it back. Just give it back. To say, look, I'm going to go back and spend 2 or 3 years working in whatever way you want to work, whether it's in a legal aid society, whether it's in some other kind of situation in Mississippi. Just because you were trained as a lawyer does not mean you get to practice law in Mississippi. You can do administrative work, you can be a public servant. You can run for office, too, and try to make a change that way. But I think that you have a moral responsibility to give back to the community. That's what has been given to you in a lot of different ways. Not just you, but everybody in this room has a responsibility to give back. I think you really do. And you can make a profound difference. Be surprised, you really can. I remember in 1964, we invited white students to come to Mississippi, and they invaded the state, as you know. They were called invaders by Ross Barnett and the governor at that time. They made a profound difference. And even the superficial thing that happened in Mississippi, they made a profound difference. The way you travel a thousand miles start with the first step. The way you climb a high mountain is begin climbing it. That's how you start. And when you break down these in irretractable poverty and race and class and sex, barriers by working at it, by working on it. That's how you start. And I'm not sure we're going to ever see the day when we're going to have a classless society and we're going to have justice and freedom, equality everywhere, but at least we can work on it and get us closer to that point of trying to get it. That's how I look at it. Did I answer your question? A moral responsibility. You've been blessed by God to guide you where you are with a lot of hard work. Give it back. Well, you can always make money. Money's easy to make in this country. This is a capitalist society. You got a good brain, which you all do have. You wouldn't be here if you didn't. You can make money after 2 or 3 years of public service. Then go make $60,000, $70,000, $100,000. Live in a nice house.
Hi, Mayor. What do you think it would take to make Washington, D.C. secure, every street safe right now?
What would it take to make Boston secure? Or Cambridge secure? Or Chicago?
Take your pick.
It takes a change in values and attitude on the part of people who live in these cities, that we're not going to take it anymore, that we're going to try to reach out. We're going to have a value system where a mother does not allow her son to come into the house with a gold chain and Nike outfits and Air Jordan shoes, and I ask where it came from, that we're not going to let drug trafficking take place on my block or in my neighborhood or in my house, that we're going to stand up to the drug dealers, that we're going to work on trying to eliminate the root cause, which is poverty, et cetera. That's the long term. Short term, in order to make any city in America safe, I think we'd have to have a curfew from midnight to 6-7 o'clock. In Boston and Cambridge, they'd have to have the National Guard to walk our streets, patrol our streets, maybe they have an army. But that's not what we want to do, though. We want to try to get the community to be safe, because it says I'm going to be safe among ourselves. We're going to rise up against it. In those areas of the city of Washington where people say we're not going to take it anymore, it is safe. Relatively speaking, you always have some criminal activity in America. There's no way you have a crime-free America, because there are going to always be some criminals, but you can increase to the point where it is safe by community involvement. That's my solution to it, massive community involvement. If the people in Boston and Cambridge said we're not going to take it anymore, you don't have any criminal activity in Cambridge or in Boston or in Washington or Chicago. At least it wouldn't be negligible. That's how I see it.
I'd like to get back to the new McCarthyism, and leaving aside Charles Lewis or Karen Johnson, just politically speaking, what do you have to say about the numbers of people from your administrations who've had to resign or who've been under investigation for various things? And does that say anything about the company you may choose to keep? In that, media hype aside, that might be a pattern of who you choose to have around you.
I've been in office 11 years. We have over 40,000 D.C. government employees. We have half a dozen who've been indicted or have pleaded guilty and gone to jail. I think that's an incredible record. If you look at 40,000 employees, 10 years, over 11 years now, Marion Barry's administration, any one employee who violates the public trust is too much for me. But think about it, 6 high-ranking people out of 40,000 in 10 years, 11 years, that's an incredible record. Look at the Reagan administration. I mean, folks, this ain't about President Reagan. People went to jail. You know, got people going to jail with the Beck, what's that thing in New York?
Webtech.
Look at all the people going to jail around Webtech. Does it say anything about the Reagan administration? It happened during President Reagan's term. Wait a second. No, but proportionally, I've had less people to go to jail than Reagan. Look at New York. We don't have people in public service who just are dishonest. When you fire them, you get rid of them. In every one of those cases of people who went to jail in my administration, it was Marion Barry who identified where they were. I identified the fact that one of my dear friends of 20-some years, Ivan O'Donnell, was the one who took some money. I did that. Marion Barry did that. We took the information and turned it over to the U.S. Attorney. Not the U.S. Attorney. I did that. Same thing true with Al Hill. I did that. And so the half dozen people have gone because I said it's wrong to do. I identified what they did and gave it to the U.S. Attorney. And I said a lot about Marion Barry. If you got a friend over 20-some years who have struggled with you in the civil rights movement, who was your campaign manager in 78, your campaign manager in 82, close personal friends, have been to each other's house, whose wives have associated with each other, and you turn that person in, what did I say about Marion Barry? Did I say a lot? Doesn't it? But doesn't it? It says, I have great integrity and don't tolerate it. It says about me, but 6 out of 11 years, incredible record. I'm not proud of those 6, really, but it's incredible record.
I got a general question for you, but it addresses a specific problem in the D.C. area that I know. I grew up in Potomac, Maryland, lived in Falls Church, Virginia. And one of the problems, I think, in D.C., and it's probably indicative of a problem of a lot of the other cities in the country, is that the suburbs, in a lot of ways, do not bear some of the responsibilities, both for infrastructure in terms of transportation, in terms of public housing, in terms of health care. And I'm trying to think of some strategies that you may have developed that may address that, whether it's better communication or whatever you think of.
Well, you're right about that. Washington comprises about 20% of the region's population. We have 7-8% of the region's public housing, 80% of the region's AFDC recipients, these are aid to families for the children, 85% of the region's homeless people, 70% of the region's poverty. And so we are trying desperately to get the suburbs to live to their responsibility by talking to the officials at Fairfax in Maryland, and in Prince George's and in Montgomery County. But it's going to take the citizens of those communities to also say we ought to reach out and help our own. And it's beginning to happen. Mayor Moran in Alexandria is beginning to take on more responsibility for the homeless. They got now have shelters in Alexandria than how they have any before. We're trying to push the problem back out to them by talking to them about the problem. But it's not easy, not just true of Washington, but Philadelphia has the same problem. Philadelphia and Chicago, Los Angeles, where the suburbs are richer, and yet they don't bear their proportionate share of the problems, the burdens of poverty. They are responsible to do so, and ought to do so. So we've got to keep talking to them, keep pushing them, and keep just urging them to do it. That's all I think we can do. What time?
I have time for one more question. I'm going to take the liberty to ask it. My question is that, you know, Jesse Jackson has become a resident of the District of Columbia. I wonder what you think about his role in District of Columbia and whether or not you think that there's any conflict between what he is trying to do locally and nationally in Washington and what you're trying to accomplish as mayor. Does he have a role in District of Columbia?
That's an excellent question. First of all, I'm glad Jesse Jackson moved to Washington. The quality of life in Washington is better than the quality of life in Chicago. Really, you have a better mayor, I think, in Washington. But also, Jesse is a very charismatic, articulate, thoughtful, forceful person. He and I have known each other over 20-some years, almost 25 years at least. I supported him in 84, one of the first big city mayors to support him in 84. He and I are personal friends. I think his agenda is similar to mine. He wants statehood for Washington. I do too. He wants to improve our education system. I do too. He wants to try to eradicate this drug scourge. I do too. Those are his three items on his agenda. And therefore, we welcome his participation in it. He didn't come to Washington to run for mayor. He likes to use the analogy of Moses going to Egypt. That Moses didn't go to Egypt to get a job, he went to liberate the people of Israel. And so he didn't come to Washington to get a job. He came to help liberate us in Washington. And I welcome his participation, welcome his involvement. We talk almost every other day. And so I see it as a very positive sign because he can get news, he can convince senators to do things I can't convince them to do. He can convince Congress people to do things I can't convince them to do because of his broad constituency. He has constituents in Los Angeles that I don't have, so therefore when he talks to a congressman from Los Angeles, that's a different kind of conversation than talking to me. I only have a constituency in Washington. So we welcome Jesse's participation. In fact, I encourage him to come to Washington. When he bought the house over by Howard University, it was vacant for a while, so I said, man, I said, why don't you get you're adding to the neighborhood. You have a negative environmental impact on the neighborhood. Why don't you get your house fixed up? And he said, well, why don't you help me get an architect? So I suggested an architect to him. And now the architect is down working to get his house together. And it was Paul Devereaux. He's one of Washington's finest black architects. And so we welcome him there. The media has tried desperately to put a wedge between us, try to make it seem as though we're on a collision course, that he's doing something I'm not interested in and vice versa. But we're right together. We want Washington to be the very best city it can ever be. We want statehood. And so Jesse Jackson added a good factor. In fact, I kid him sometimes. I said, Jesse Jackson, you couldn't make it to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but you were at 6116 Street, so at least you got close. He lives in an apartment called Rittenhouse. I said, you couldn't make it to the White House, you're in the Rittenhouse. So that's how close we are. Thank you very much.